You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has thousands upon thousands of retail locations all over the United States, and they offer great batteries, right? Now, I got a buddy who is kind of a car nut, a truck nut, and he told me that, I guess on the research that he's done for car batteries, Interstate Battery car batteries and truck batteries are some of the highest quality, most reliable truck batteries that they have on the market. I don't know anything about it. It's just what my buddy told me. So if you're looking for a new car or truck battery, you need to go to your local retail, Interstate Battery retail shop, and go pick one up, because I guess they're badass. So I know I have one in my truck. Other than that, if you have TV remote controls, Interstate Batteries makes a battery for that. They make batteries for your rangefinder, your trail cameras, and basically any other electrical device, for the most part, that you use while hunting or fishing or being outside. They also have a whole bunch of other little knick-knack products too, like my buddy Dan Spano. He is a manager for his family's Interstate Battery retail location. He got me some of these cool flashlights that have switches on them. One of them looks like a lantern. So they have a whole bunch of that stuff too. If you want to find out more information about the kind of batteries that Interstate Batteries makes, head on over to interstatebatteries.com or visit your local retail store.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys, welcome back. Land and Legacy. Land and Legacy. Ooh, I can't even say our name. Land and Legacy Podcast, special treat for you this week. Going to hear back from Frank and Kyle. Kyle Hedges, Frank Longcarriage, consultants for Land and Legacy. They are, a very in-depth, very educational, tons of information from these guys. Years and years of experience, but they're going to be chatting with you guys this week.
Here's the thing that I love about them and their approach is it's kind of like if you talk with a hunter, a deer hunter, and you talk with a trapper, you know, a deer hunter, they want to get within like 40 yards of their game. A trapper wants the paw of
inches.
Whatever. They're talking game of inches. A lot of times when you hear Kyle and Frank talk, it's kind of that same comparison. We talk a lot about, you know, landscapes and ecosystems and managing them and how game are going to utilize them and, you know, just be
historical data and manipulating the landscape with restoration.
Sometimes when they talk specifically on upland game bird management, upland management, we're talking very, very specific spaces that have to be there. And you know, plants, like individual plants that
they're
have
almost
to be
220
present.
Grit.
They're pretty fine.
Yeah, they're pretty fine
in their
tuned in their information as far as like the details. You know, we
I
talked
think it's a good balance
last week maybe about 80 grit, or maybe it was
last week.
So we talked about 80 grit, and they do some things at 80 grit. But coming from a background where they work so much with upland game birds,
the spatial factor that they bring to the table when managing quail that have, you know, we're talking different home ranges, different usages, and travel, you know, 40 yards to a quail is much different to 40 yards from a wild turkey or a deer. So the finite details that they bring to the table in managing landscapes is awesome.
And it's not only, like, let's just say, because they're not just upland guys, they're diehard deer hunters and turkey hunters as well. But their way of managing specifically on some of these public lands for upland birds have created phenomenal deer and turkey hunting as well, because the habitat is so great because it's managed so intensively for upland birds that the deer and turkey flourish because
yeah, man,
it's way better than some of the other properties or than a lot of the properties around. Like if you go to some of the places managed by these guys, you're going to be in drooling looking at how great it is. So tons of information, and hopefully you guys enjoy it. But before we kick it over to them, remember, we just launched our virtual property tours, kind of a online, almost like an online college course, but it's more of an interview and exchange between us for us to help you on your property to avoid consultation fees or us having to go to your property. So we work really in depth with you through that. Go to the website, landandlegacy.tv, to check it out. Also, just talked about it this week, so go check our other podcast out when we talk about our consulting or our real estate services and consulting that you can use no matter what state you're in.
Does it not matter? We're talking Kansas, Iowa, Indiana, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, you name it. We'll be there and help out.
For sure.
We've got our ways.
Except Louisiana in July.
Yeah. We've been there twice.
Twice, and I don't want to go back.
You guys are on your own. Sorry on that.
Oh, we will be at the Whitetail Weekend in March at Athens, Georgia, with Cutie May. So if you haven't signed up or you're thinking about that, check it out.
I don't think it's quite open yet for registration. They're still.
Did I let the cat out of the bag too early?
No, I don't think so. They'll just be a long line waiting at the door, let's say, to get in and get tickets online. But that is. March is not far away. It's just not.
No.
So we've got to really start preparing for that and NWTF too. That'll
be a fun
event.
Mid-February, Nashville, Gaylord Opryland Hotel.
Yep. We'll have a booth there. Come by and check us out. And a lot of cool things happening.
All right, guys. Enjoy Frank and Kyle.
Kyle Hedges here again.
Hey, guys. Frank Longcarriage.
Hey, we're going to talk to you today about prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse. We hopefully you listened to our previous podcast. We were out in Wyoming, eastern Wyoming, and hunting sage grouse and blue grouse. Well, on our way home, we were making a multi-species trip out of this. We were coming right through Nebraska, southwest Nebraska, and Frank had a good connection on a big private ranch that has a lot of prairie chickens on it. We decided to stop in there. We hunted one afternoon and just a few hours this morning. So a little bit of road noise if you hear in the background. We're traveling home from a multi-day western hunt. But
Yep. This was a hunt where we had the possibility of taking home four different species of grouse, and we were able to do it. So yesterday, we were hunting sharptails we were hunting prairie chickens yesterday and this morning. But on this particular ranch, there is a small number of sharp-tailed grouse. This part of Nebraska that we're hunting, is really on the southern edge of sharp-tailed grouse. So the vast majority of birds that we saw were prairie chickens. In fact, we only saw one sharp-tailed grouse, and I was able to harvest it. So we're able to get four grouse species out of this trip.
Yep, pretty neat. That doesn't happen every day or, you know, any trip. A lot of times you're just going after one species, and the opportunity to get multiple species like that is pretty neat. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about the habitat, of course. We always like to cover some of that, and we're going to share a little bit of just about how the hunt went and some of the conditions we dealt with and some of the adjustments we had to make. Again, I'll make reference back to the Wyoming podcast. If you listen to that, we're both going to admit we are not blue grouse biologists.
Right.
We
absolutely.
We got schooled by the blue grouse, partly probably because of the population levels, but also we just got schooled somewhat.
Yeah, yeah.
We can accept defeat. That's okay. Sometimes that's going to happen. Prairie chickens are a little different thing here for us. I've spent several years in the northern Flint Hills after college, working on landscapes that had quail, pheasants, and prairie chickens. So did quite a bit of prairie chicken habitat management. Even in southwest Missouri, where I'm currently located now, I had prairie chickens on a few of my areas for several years. They blinked out about 10 years ago, but that's kind of happened all across the state, and we'll address more of that too in this podcast. And yeah. Frank, go ahead.
Yeah. So I kind of earned my biologist chops, so to speak, on greater prairie chickens. I worked on greater prairie chickens in Kansas for my master's degree work, earned my master's doing prairie chicken survival and movements in the Flint Hills. And then when I came to Missouri and began to work for the Department of Conservation, I was placed on the prairie chicken recovery team. Missouri's prairie chicken population had gotten to critically low levels. We were down to a few isolated populations, and we were starting to get to some genetic bottlenecks there. And the population really needed an infusion of new genetics, and it needed an infusion of new blood. So I was, as a part of that team, because of my experience in Kansas working on my master's, we went out, and Kyle, I think, went one time, I guess, but
yep.
Spent 5 years trapping prairie chickens in the Flint Hills, or excuse me, the Smoky Hills of Kansas, to release back in Missouri in the southwest, west central part of the state. And then I spent 2 years or two seasons working in Nebraska trapping greater prairie chickens for release in northern Missouri. So the prairie chicken is a species that's close to my heart. I've worked since 2001 in some aspect of prairie chicken research or management. And I just absolutely love the species. They're charismatic. They've got an elaborate breeding display that is, if you've had a chance to see it, is just awesome. If not, I would recommend trying to see it. And they're a prairie species. I'm a prairie person at heart, and they're a prairie grouse. And so the opportunity to study them was phenomenal. The opportunity to help with the population in Missouri was also great, and the opportunity to hunt them is always fun.
Yeah, and I've had hunting experience as well as, like I said, the management experience and some trapping experience as well. I've hunted them a fair amount in Kansas. I've hunted them a couple times in Nebraska before this trip. So
yeah, I've hunted them in Kansas. So, and we'll talk about this. The prairie chicken hunting is kind of different than maybe other upland bird hunting. Prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse, They're a wide open prairie species. They use their flight abilities to escape. They're not one that hunkers down like a covey of quail might. They're not one that runs like a pheasant might. Their ability to get away from predators is predicated on their vision. So they can be very spooky. So most of them are harvested in the wintertime as they're flying into feed fields. So prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse in the wintertime fly into feed fields, which can be anything from an alfalfa wet meadow in Nebraska to milo, corn, soybeans throughout the Midwest. And people pass shoot them like you're hunting ducks or doves. In the early season, so starting in September, there's a lot of states, so from Kansas north to North Dakota, they have an early prairie chicken or prairie grouse season. The birds are in smaller groups. They're less spooky. You can approach them with the bird dog, and you can actually get some points and some fun hunting that way. So I've hunted them both ways in Kansas, the pass shooting traditional way, and then the early season, of course, hunting over dogs.
Yeah, and most of both of ours experiences is the early season. The flying into fields is kind of fascinating for anybody that's ever done that or heard about it. When you see them flying into a field, and that's, we're not going to address much of this beyond what I'm going to say right now, because that's not how we're hunting them. But if you see birds flying into a field, prairie chickens, say flying into milo stubble at 9:07 in the morning in December 10th or whatever, you can be there tomorrow at 9:05 and set up, and they're going to fly over the same spot,
yeah,
at 9:07.
Right.
Yep. It is a fascinating deal. So basically people get them patterned, they time it, they get there, boom, 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 you get a few shots.
Yep.
I can tell you they are flying really fast sometimes, yep, depending on how far out into that field they're going to go. It looks like they're just a balloon up there, but they'll fly 50, 60 miles an hour sometimes.
It's amazing. A lot of times they've got elevation that they're coming off of a high hill, flying down into a valley or flying down into a field, and they're just, they're smoking.
Yep.
It's a fun way to hunt. It's challenging.
Yep. And then, so if you have luck and do that, well, now you've disrupted that routine. So the next day you can't go to the exact same spot at the same time typically. They may come to that feed field, but now they're going to come in from the west side instead of the south side, or they will adjust it. They may change their time. And it's just a fascinating bird, that feeding behavior and how specific of a time they'll stick to. But what we were doing in this early season, so it's last week of September. Actually, today's the last day of September. So we were already going to be coming through Nebraska, traveling on I-80. And Frank had an inside on a landowner and was willing to give us permission to hunt. And tens of thousands of acres of good, mixed grass prairie.
Yeah, sort of southern end of the Sand Hills, Nebraska Sand Hills. Most people think of the Nebraska Sand Hills and Sharptail and prairie chicken hunting around Valentine and Halsey and places like that. And there are certainly lots of birds there. We were just kind of on the south end of that coming through and happened to have a contact, and we're so appreciative of this landowner allowing us to hunt. And he even put us on birds this morning that we never would have found without his help. So much, much appreciation to him.
Yep. So kind of a little background to how this played out, and a little, explaining. Yesterday, we're traveling in the morning, so we knew we were going to have yesterday afternoon and then this morning to hunt. We were only going to have 2 half days to hunt, and even this morning, we weren't even going to have a full half day. So we were in kind of a time crunch, but we wanted to give it a go. We were going to be coming right through here. So we roll in yesterday around noon, and it's 75 degrees.
Yeah, every bit of it, yep.
And the wind is blowing easy, a straight 30.
Yeah, and gusting to 40.
Yeah, it just was terrible.
And it was
conditions
out of the south. And so you can imagine how hot and windy and dry. The almost the absolute worst conditions that I would choose to hunt upland game birds would be yesterday's conditions. If I lived in western Nebraska, I would stay home and watch football yesterday instead of going to hunt prairie grouse.
Terrible for the dogs, too hot, just, not good. But what are you going to do? We're 10, 12 hours from home. We're going to hunt. So we, one of the strategies for hunting this time of year is the birds will hang around the leks. That's where they boom. That's where they do their mating ritual in the spring. And so a lot of these males anyway, but sometimes even the females and broods will be not too far away. But there seems to be concentrations around these leks. They'll gather at these leks in the fall right now and kind of establish their pecking order. They have a real complex hierarchy system of who is in charge, and even though they all live together, it's kind of a unique thing as well. And no different than turkeys, I guess,
but
a little more extreme maybe with prairie chickens. And so they hang around these leks, so you got to figure out where the leks are. And if you've never hunted this place, if you've never been on this place, luckily Frank had a little intel on where some of the leks were, but even without that, it's somewhat predictable. You're looking for in the Flint Hills lots of times, in Kansas it'd be the real high ridges. It's going to be shorter grass. They're not going to do their display and fighting with each other in grass that's knee high. It's going to be pretty open spots.
Yeah, open ridge top, something that's overgrazed, something like that. So they can get a lot of visual. They can be seen a long ways, and then they can hear because they're making a sound, a booming sound that needs to carry. And so they're trying to get this elevation, and the lek is really the life history's center of a prairie chicken is the lek. This is where everything occurs, and so they spend almost every month of the year. They'll come to the lek at some point, maybe not in July, early August, but at some point during the year these leks are important. And so they're going to be hanging around them somewhere.
Yep. And out here where we're at, it's a little different than where I've been in the Flint Hills. The ridgetops here have quite a bit of grass on them. So right off the bat, that's not where the leks are going to be for the most part.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, so where are some areas that are going to be, you know, real short, overgrazed? Well, out here in southwest Nebraska, it's going to be a couple things we found. Windmills, right?
Yep.
That's where the water source is. So the cows are coming in there, it's overgrazed. Well, guess what? That's where several leks are on this property.
Windmills always seem to have a lek at each windmill.
Yep. And the second part of it is prairie dog towns. Some of the prairie dog towns were associated with windmills, so it just made it a bigger short grass area, but some aren't. And once again, we praised Onyx Maps for our Wyoming part of this trip. It marks prairie dog towns.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Literally looking at a private ranch that we've never hunted in Onyx Maps, and we can identify probably some leks just by these prairie dog town locations.
Yep. These leks showed up, or these prairie dog towns showed up, and these windmills showed up on Onyx. And if you've never been to a place, if you're hunting in this part of the world, and you see on Onyx this is a prairie dog town that's marked, or this looks like a windmill, there's a pretty good chance there's a lek there. And even if you're hunting in September, like we said, the birds are going to come to the lek. And if you show up at, say, noon or 1 o'clock, there's no birds on the lek because they show up early in the morning, do their thing, and they show up again in the evening. So in the afternoon or late morning, if you show up and there's no birds there, you can quickly look around. So walk around these potential lek sites, these windmills, these prairie dog towns. And if you start to see droppings, you start to see feathers because these birds are going to fight. They're going to lose feathers. You can identify, hey, this is probably a lek site just by the sign that's left there. And so this is probably a pretty good place to start, and I can start planning my hunt from there.
Yep, and that's exactly what we did. We rolled into the very first windmill, also had a prairie dog town associated with it. We get out. What do you know? We find droppings. We find feathers. We find everything we need. Tells us, hey, there's birds here somewhere.
Yeah, so we identify this, and we think, okay, well, let's use our knowledge as biologists that we've gained over the years, and also as prairie chicken hunters that we've gained over the years, and let's start to hunt these ridgetops. So a lot of times when they're not right at the lek, the males will move off of the lek and go to the ridgetops, go to the areas that are a little bit shorter vegetation and feed. They're looking for grasshoppers this time of year, and of course forbs and greens are still very, very important. So, and the ridgetops afford a lot of visibility. So the first thing we did is there was a ring of ridge, kind of a ring of high ridges that kind of surrounded this lek, and we started walking that. And Kyle, this wasn't probably the best idea for this particular hunt.
Absolutely not. So we're walking along and we haven't seen anything. We saw a few antelope, but we haven't seen any prairie chickens. And I don't know what was, we probably made a couple mile loop out of this
anyway
deal. It's hot and it's windy and the dogs are already hating us for this because it's...
Yep.
But we both haven't been around prairie chickens enough and haven't done management on prairie chickens, and we've hunted them. We're about three quarters through this and, you know, we're spaced out. We're hunting 70, 80 yards apart. But we kind of come together and we both look at each other and said, it's way too thick.
Yep, way too thick.
The little blue stem is up to mid thigh.
Yeah,
they've had a bunch of rain out here. I don't, you know, if people are aware, but a lot of the West didn't have near as bad of western fire season this year because it was a wetter year, which is great. You don't want people's property and houses burning up out West, but it made the vegetation grow up. And prairie chickens don't want to hang out in that stuff, especially if it's 75 degrees.
Yeah, absolutely not. And prairie grouse, prairie chickens and sharptails both, if you're used to hunting pheasants and you're used to hunting tall grass, tall, you know, CRP that's thigh to waist high, you're probably wasting your time on prairie grouse. You've got to get out of that mode of thinking. Not all game birds like this thick grass that we've talked about. We've talked about it on quail podcast. Quail don't like thick grass. And the same thing with the bird that spend its whole life on the prairie. This grass can get too thick. And this year, this ranch... And again, much credit goes to the landowner. He manages his property in a way that he's managing it for conditions that they normally have. So if they have a wet year, he's not going to bring in a bunch of cattle and really graze it down. He's going to continue keeping his stocking rate, knowing that next year, hey, it may be dry, it may be a drought. And so he really takes great care of his grass. He has a ton of grass left over the winter. There's going to be tons of residual cover. Winter survival is probably going to be really great for these prairie grouse. And he really takes great care of his ranch. But bottom line, first walk, doing what we normally would do on an early season prairie chicken hunt, way too thick, didn't work out.
What's kind of funny, too, is, you know, you and I have never prairie chicken hunted together.
No.
We've hunted a lot of stuff together, but we've never prairie chicken hunted together. I've done it. He's done it, but we've never done it together.
Yep.
But we both immediately, well, not immediately, we walked longer than we should have, but we were kind of, once you commit to a loop like that,
you're kind of stuck.
We were kind of stuck to finish it out anyway, but we both came to the same conclusion. This is way too thick. We got to do something different. We got to figure something out. So we stepped back and said, well, let's go check out the next windmill. Let's go check out the next, you know, potential lek site. And we pull in there, and as we're driving into this, we realize, hey, right around the windmill's overgrazed, right? It's a pool table.
Yep. Cows spend a lot of time there.
That's where they're going to dance and do their stuff. And we're not going to be able to shoot them there. There's just no cover.
Can't get close to them.
But then there's this kind of this 200-yard radius of medium graze stuff outside this overgrade right around the water tank. So you kind of have this transition zone of medium graze before you get into all this little blue stem up to our mid-thigh.
Yeah, so the cool thing about this transition zone of medium graze grass or medium graze pastures, we got to looking, there was quite a bit more diversity there as far as weedy growth. There was some annual weeds there. There were some forbs, some typical prairie forbs, some coneflowers, some liatris, some lead plant, whatnot. But it was a lot more annual weeds than, say, out in the main prairie, and then certainly more than the overgraze. So this real diverse kind of growth had a lot of insects that you would really think, hey, this is a good, you know, if I was a prairie chicken, I would have all the resources that I need right here.
Yep, so we strike out. We say, hey, let's make this adjustment. Let's make a swing through that. We'll just kind of walk this outer radius around this water hole and see if anything works, you know. Again, still brutal conditions.
Yeah.
We're thinking at this point, if we'll probably see some birds somewhere. They may get up at 100 yards.
Yeah,
we're going to be lucky to, when it's windy like that, they get skittish, and it just makes it really tough. And, of course, you're not going to get much dog work either, but we strike out around there. Sure enough, a couple pop up long. We don't get shots at them. But, you know, we don't go another 300 or 400 yards making that circle, and one gets up and I kill it.
Yep.
Hey, maybe we're on to something.
Yep, maybe we figured something out.
And you never know. I always say you catch one fish, it could be a fluke. You catch two fish, the same depth, the same lure, the same thing, I probably got a pattern.
Right,
so,
right.
We're thinking maybe we're on to something, but we got to confirm that.
Yep.
We got to go to the next windmill.
We've got more windmills to check out to try to confirm this pattern. And so off we go to the next windmill. And lucky for us, there were two track trails that went from windmill to windmill, and the landowner gave us permission to drive down the two tracks, and which saved us a bunch because the landscape between windmills may have had some chickens somewhere in there, but it would have been, this is a 14, 15,000 acre plus ranch, and it's just vast amounts of sandhills as far as you can see that all look the same. So you've got to try to narrow your search pattern down. And so it was lucky for us, we were able to drive, you know, within a quarter mile of a windmill before we started, which really helped a lot.
Oh, and yeah, I mean, some of these are over a mile apart. I mean, if we were hiking all this, we'd have been done. The dogs have been done. So the other nice thing with this terrible conditions and this hot and wind is now we're making these shorter loops, so we're able, and we're at windmills, right? Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of water. Of course, we had water in the truck for the dogs too, but we're able to make these shorter little 30-minute circles, and
Yeah, give the dogs a break.
Give the dogs a break. Give us a break. It's hot. It's windy. We're on day four. We've been hunting 3 days in Wyoming. Yep. You know, our feet are a little beat up. And so off we go to the next one to try this again. And I think we were about 80% around the loop.
Mm-hmm. We were, yeah.
And boom, one pops, flies to the left a little long.
Yeah, it got up about 35 to 40 yards by the time I reacted. It was a 40 to 45 yard shot. And on prairie grouse, that's about right. That's about typical. And I took a crack at it and didn't hit it, which isn't surprising, right?
Yep. And so then Frank takes about three more steps, and one gets up right in front of him, flying pretty much dead away. And
a little quartering away, but yeah, one of those where I was just putting a shell in my gun, and I got up, and I was on it. It was one of those where you see it in your head, you see it in your mind, that, okay, I've got the perfect lead, and all I've got to do is slap the trigger. I mean, it's coming, right? He's already got one chicken in the bag. I don't have my chicken yet.
Yep.
And I'm just fixing to slap the trigger, and the thing crashes out of the air magically, right?
Yep.
It hit a stone wall. I don't know what happened.
So, yeah, it's his bird. It's right in front of him, and I've got a crossing shot because I'm 30 yards off to his right. And hey, I told him I didn't know what he was doing. He might have been reloading his gun. He might have been doing who knows what. Yeah. I didn't know what he was doing over there, and so we had a little ribbon over that. But I short shot him pretty bad.
Yeah,
smoked it right out from in front of him. But
yep.
Hey, with good buddies, there's that's just how the game's played sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes so. That goes on, and I'll remember that. I mean, that's something I'll remember. I'm sure
I'll get payback for it.
And if I don't pay him back, I'll remember it and hold it over his head for a long time.
Well, I still don't feel bad about it. So.
Oh, I didn't. I know you didn't when it happened.
Nope. Worked out just fine for me, thought. So.
And hey, so, yeah.
The advice is you better be quick to get your gun to your shoulder.
Yeah,
when I was a kid, I was telling Frank and I had this conversation after I short shot him. We had this conversation at the motel. You know, we spoil our kids. I've tried to get them lined up. Here's a dog on point or whatever.
Yep.
And
yep.
Shoot, when I was a kid and we were quail hunting, first of all, I'd be the one sent into the thicket to flush them out,
uh-huh.
So I'm completely out of position. And secondly, there was no mercy. If you couldn't get your gun to your shoulder quick enough to outdraw my dad and his buddies, well, quail were falling everywhere, and there I was just standing there.
Yeah.
So I guess I was raised that way. So
I've been in some of those situations, and I teased my dad a little bit about this. I remember one time with my dad and my cousin, we were hunting in western Kansas, and there was a little patch of tall kochia weed. If you've ever hunted out there, it's a tall weed that pheasants really like to burrow into. So I was right in the middle of that kochia patch. I don't know, I was 14 or 15, and my dad and my cousin were on either side of it, kind of standing on a hump. And I was right in the middle of that kochia patch, and there was, I don't know, we got them hemmed up at the very end, and pheasants were coming out of every one rooster after another. And every time I drew down on a rooster, it would fall. Every time. I went through 3 to 4 roosters that I drew down on, and every one of them crashed, hit the ground. And they were smiling when I came out of that ditch. They were proud of themselves, and I wasn't very proud of them, but hey.
No mercy.
No mercy back then. They were, you know, they were good to get me on pheasants and get me on quail and do all that. But that particular time, I remember there was no mercy. And now, well, Caleb killed my son killed his first Bob White last year. Dogs went on point. I got Caleb up there, got him in front of me, and got him in all position. And Covey Quail gets up and he kills one. So we kind of spoil them a little bit. But
I guess. I think part of it is the population was so much stronger then that, you know, our dads didn't have to line us up and give us the shot because they knew we were going to get in 10 coveys a day.
Yeah.
So, hey, it was every man for himself, and eventually the kid would get a few shots off too, you know. So, but anyway.
He back to it. He short shoots me.
Yeah.
We're heading back to the truck. So we got another couple hundred yards back to the truck. And he's talking, and I'm not saying a whole lot. I'm just still trying to think about it. So we get to the truck and we head on to the next lick. And so it wasn't long, and we head over to the next lek, and sharptail flushes, and I kill this sharptail right out of the air, dead, right?
Yeah, shooting, right, yeah, yeah.
Knock him right out.
Olympic shooting team is what this was, yeah.
Yeah, so I knock this sharptail. He gets up at the, I don't know, probably 30 yards, and miss him the first shot. He's flying out there, and I knock him down the second shot. I didn't knock him down. I winged him, and he sails out there and then crashes. So we got a good location. So here's the thing about prairie grouse. So I've seen this with sharptails, seen this with greater prairie chickens, and with sage grouse. They are, they're a bird that is not extremely tough. If you get a couple of pellets in them, a lot of times they'll go down right then. If not, and if they sail a little bit and they go down, if that happens on a pheasant, it's running. It's taken off.
Yeah, they got Scooby-Doo legs, yeah, on the way down. They're already spinning and they're gone.
If a prairie grouse, you wing it or you drop a leg and it, you know, flies another 80 yards and lands, crashes, it's going to be right there. You, yep, just got to keep a mark on it and get your dog there because it's going to be there. And so that's what happened with this. Walk out there.
But the story doesn't end there.
No,
the old wing tippet was actually one pellet in the liver, I think.
Yeah, so Kyle's dad dog actually goes around and points this bird, and I think the bird is...
Yeah, we're thinking it's dead, lung pellet in the lung or something. Yeah. It probably, you know, flew 100 yards and crashed. That's, yeah, going to be laying there dead.
Yeah. Well, little did I know that it's not dead. It gets up, and it's just flying barely grass top high. The dog's on its tail. And I'm worried about shooting because I don't want to hit the dog. I mean, that's the most important thing of your hunt is safety. And so we're always conscious of that. So this bird is flying low. The dog's on its tail. And it finally clears where I can get a shot. And I'm still focusing, kind of being careful about where the dog was. And I really didn't bear down, and so bottom line is I missed this bird, and it
three more times, let's tell them that.
Anyway, I missed this bird. We don't have to talk. I mean, that's not a necessary part of the story, right?
It is in my story.
Well, yeah, bottom line is I missed the bird, right?
Yep.
So it goes, I don't know, it goes maybe another 80 yards, goes over a little rise. But then we don't see it come back out of the bowl. Think, okay, it's over there again. So let's truck over there. This time we go over there, the dog goes on point and picks it up. It's dead. It's stone dead. It had just made it over the ridge, and it was stone dead when we got there. So I don't know. Sometimes that happens.
Yep.
Bottom line is, though, I got my sharp-tail grouse.
Well, right? And as the for the entire hunt, for both of us, that completed the fourth species, you know, yes, the maximum possible species we were going to kill on this trip. And we really didn't know if we'd pick up a sharp tail. That was just going to be a real bonus.
That
on
would
this.
Have been an extreme bonus to get a sharp
so,
tail.
So we got it. So overall, he got a bird. Now he's not whining so much about me short shooting, yep, him. He's got a sharpie, and so life's better. We continue on, I guess. We checked a couple more windmills and, yeah, had some birds flush long, and then stumble into one more, and I finish a limit.
Yep.
So.
And it was extremely tough conditions. I mean, we're still talking 75 degrees with hot,
yep,
hot wind, strong wind, low humidity. So the smelling conditions were terrible. The birds were getting up long. They were getting up at the edge of range. It was again, one of those days where if you're a resident in a prairie landscape where you've got the opportunity to hunt prairie grouse multiple days, it's a day not to go. I mean, you can go. It's, yep, a day I wouldn't recommend. But when we're here, we're not going to go sit in the hotel room and look at each other. So we're going to get out and hunt. And it paid off. We hunted less than a half a day, and Kyle got a limit, and I got a sharp tail out of it. And we've got a new pattern, though, and several more walkable windmills for the next morning.
Oh, and it, hey, we, truthfully, with those conditions and going into it, We were kind of thinking if we kill a bird or two, this will be a bonus.
Right.
So.
I told him, I said, if we kill a prairie chicken, I would consider this a bonus today.
Yeah.
Just it knowing.
Was that bad.
Yeah, so. just knowing how spooky and how jumpy they are in those conditions.
So it worked out great. Had a good time and got some birds killed and went to the motel, spent the night there. And we had this morning then, we had one last run at this. Of course, we knew getting up early we were going to have cooler conditions.
Yep.
Assuming
the
wind would die, which it did. I mean, you know, it's western Nebraska. The wind always blows, but it was certainly maybe 10-mile-an-hour wind this morning before sunrise.
Yeah, so. It was pleasant.
So we kind of had in mind we had a couple more windmills to check that we hadn't been to.
Yep.
Going to stick with the same pattern, but one of the problems with only having first thing in the morning to hunt, we needed to be on the road by about 10:30 today, so we only had from sunrise wasn't even till 7:38 or something, so we really only had about 3 hours to do this. Well, not all the birds go to the lek, but that's what we were keying on, was these leks and this medium gray stuff around it. Well, first thing in the morning, they're actually out on that overgrazed pool table stuff.
They're on the lek. So it's, like Kyle said, a pool table. And, you know, they're out there and they're actually displaying. They're doing, they're fighting. They're doing the dominance thing. They're displaying. They're making the sounds. They're not doing it as intensely as they are in the spring when hens are on the leks. But they're still doing it. And they're doing it on a place of ground that looks like a pool table that they can see for 100 yards in each direction.
Yeah.
So they're almost impossible to. So if all of our birds were going to be there, the ones that we were going to hunt, then, you know, it was going to be a little bit tough. We didn't know how we were going to pull this off.
Right.
And first thing in the morning.
If you lived out here, if you were a resident, I would either, there's a couple things you could do, and we've talked about it. It'd be kind of fun. We've never tried this, but you could get there in the dark.
Yep.
Now, a lot of times in the spring, the birds show up in the dark. So I don't know if this would work. If they showed up too early, you couldn't kill them coming in.
But, right.
But you could almost, if some of them would fly in, they do. Some of them walk in, some of them fly into these leks. Wouldn't that be fun if they flew in when it was legal shooting time and
you
could be shooting them cupped up like ducks?
Yeah.
That would be interesting. I don't know if you could pull that off, but it would be, I'd be worth trying. But for us, where we're going to try to, you know, walk them up and hunt with dogs, really the first hour was not going to be ideal, but we were in a time crunch. We had to try to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, if I lived out here and I was going to walk them up, I wouldn't be out there at 7:30 in the morning because I know a lot of the birds are going to be on the lek, especially these males. I'd just wait and start hunting at 8:30 or 9 after they've done their little business.
Let them disperse off the lek, get in the taller grass, get approachable.
Yeah,
but we didn't have that luxury. So we roll up to within sight of the first windmill. It's kind of down in a little bowl. We thought, well, we're going to slip up to the windmill, see if we can catch birds around the edge. And we get fairly close, and Kyle stops me and says, whoa, I hear him.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we could hear him whooping. It's an unmistakable sound. They whoop. They make a boom sound. And we got up there, and we could actually see him out there. On there. So our approach to the lek, then we knew that birds were there. So the best thing we did was we just tried to get up there and see if we could get close enough for a shot.
And we were hoping there might be some of them were way out in the middle of this thing, 100 yards, but we're hoping there's some that are closer to the edge.
Yeah, maybe in the grass a little bit.
We can see 6 or 8 of them out there in the middle dancing around, and whew.
Yeah, there was what, 30 that got up?
Yeah,
probably?
We were kind of in shock.
Yeah,
they
just
all over the place.
Got up everywhere.
And they were not at the edge.
No.
They were not in range. So
these birds fly off, and most prairie grouse on the first flush, you really don't get to see them go down. They fly a long ways. That's their escape mechanism on this prairie, is they don't settle out and like a covey of quail does within sight. They just keep going. Luckily, birds on the lek this morning, they probably were going to come back, so they didn't go as far. We saw them kind of settle We saw them go over a rise, and we didn't see them come out of it, so we knew they were probably there somewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, these birds probably act a little different than some public land birds, too. So, I mean, these birds aren't getting harassed. So
right.
Us walking up there and bumping them off of this lek, you know, they probably wonder what's going on, because I'm sure the rancher, he normally drives right up there to check his windmill and the water tank and everything. But still, they're going to fly off and probably, I don't know, I guess we could have tried it, but again, we were in a time crunch. They're probably, we're going to fly back in there within the hour.
I'm sure they would have, yeah.
To get back to business, because we bumped them pretty much first thing in the morning.
Yeah, first light, yeah.
But anyway, we head the direction they go, and it pays off.
Come over a rise. Birds start to get up wild. But this is one thing I really want to stress with prairie grouse, and I've seen it with every species of prairie grouse that I've hunted. If birds get up wild and start popping up, there's usually always more birds that sit there. They do sort of a popcorn flush. So if you see a bird that gets up wild or gets up ahead of you at the edge of range, hustle up there, and more times than not, I've seen this, way more times than not, there'll be other birds that sit there and pop up, and you can get a shot. And that's exactly what happened here. There was, I don't know, four or five birds that started getting up long. We hustled to the bottom of this draw, and then sure enough, there was another bird that had set tight, and I was able to get it. Again, I don't know how many times it happens with prairie grouse species that I've hunted. Every time I hunt with somebody new, prairie chicken hunting, I say, hey, if we see a flock that gets up, let's hustle up there. More times than not, there'll be birds that sit tight. I've seen this happen so many times. I've read about it, heard about it. It's just some kind of escape mechanism or something, I don't know, with prairie grouse. I'm not sure why they do it, but you'll generally always be one that doesn't flush, maybe two. And so, sure enough, paid off this time.
Yep, worked out. Then I didn't have to hear about it anymore for short shooting him the day before. So
right.
Now he's got a prairie chicken. So
I've got my prairie chicken, my sharptail, a blue grouse, and a sage grouse. Yep. So I've got the grand slam.
Now it's every man for himself anymore. I'll short shoot him. He can short shoot me. We don't care. But no, anyway, so we go check a couple more windmills and not much happening. Flush a couple birds wild, but not much happening. And then something pops up that neither of us had ever had. The landowner catches us.
It was real lucky. He saw us. We passed him the morning on the road, and he didn't know what my truck looked like necessarily, but he saw that I had a dog. We had a dog box in the back, and so he turned around and caught us, and he said, hey, I've been meaning to get a hold of you guys. He said, I've got a pivot of alfalfa down here a few miles away that I've been seeing birds in regularly. When you guys get done with your little prairie walk, he said, come down, meet me at my headquarters, and I'll run you up there to this pivot, and you can hunt the pivot. And so we look at each other and think, okay, why not? I mean, he's seeing birds there on a regular basis. We've never hunted alfalfa pivots for prairie grouse. So we decide to walk, do our windmill thing, got a bird, and then we said, we got an hour left, let's head down to the pivot. So we get down there, the guy meets us, drives us right up, shows us the pivot, gives us some ideas. Again, so much thanks and credit to the landowner that went out of his way on a Monday morning when he probably had other things to do to show us where this pivot was. And it was alfalfa. It was a pivot of alfalfa and orchard grass that was surrounded by native prairie. And one of the key things about it, even though it wasn't, what we were walking in wasn't native species, it was orchard grass, it was alfalfa. But alfalfa is one of those plants that has billions of bugs in it. For some reason, insects love alfalfa. It is a mecca for any game bird species, old or young, but especially young. The hens will take their broods there, from turkeys to prairie grouse to quail to pheasants. They love alfalfa, not necessarily because of its green leaves, and they do eat that, but because there's so many bugs in it. It's so buggy. It's great stuff.
Yep. And so you know, we're looking at this thinking, well, what makes sense? These birds probably come from the prairie around it, and they probably just walk into the edges. There's no point in them being in the middle. They can just walk into this, feed, and of course, they're eating some of the greens, too. They're eating bugs and the greens, so this is a typical pivot. It's going to cover, you know, about 160 acres. So we're just going to walk a circle around this thing. So we get, again, about 50, 60 yards apart. And I'm closer to the edge, and he's more to the interior, and off we go. And
yeah, and again, remember, we're not hunting native prairie. We're actually hunting.
We're in the alfalfa.
In his alfalfa and orchard grass.
Which, by the way, so the medium grade stuff that we were hunting around these windmills was about shin high. Maybe, you know, the tallest to be knee high. Told you that the little blue stuff was too thick. It was too tall. It had too much rain or a lot of rain this year. Mm-hmm. And that's a key thing for prairie chickens. You're looking for that, that 12, 15 inch, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe 18 inches tops.
Yeah.
Height. They want to be able to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Prairie grouse have to have vegetation that they can see out of. They have to be able to see over it.
Well, they're just getting ready to cut this alfalfa, so it's perfect.
Yep.
It's just about shin high. We look at that. Of course, he's been seeing birds here, so all of this makes, you know, why wouldn't we try this? Yep. We've just never done this before. We've never been in a situation that had this... had a pivot like this in the middle of 15,000 acres of prairie.
Right.
So off we strike off, and I don't know. We hadn't walked probably 400 or 500 yards.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm starting to wonder, but he said he saw some birds here, and one pops up right in front of me. Somehow I managed to not kill it.
Yep.
Its buddy gets up, and somehow I managed to not kill it. So 5 shells later, I
managed to not kill 2 prairie grouse.
Managed to not shoot a double. When it first started, I thought, oh, here we go. After I missed the first one, I thought, well, I'll just shoot his buddy here. And somehow I managed to not kill any. So making fun of his sharp tail, little escapade, at least he ended up finally getting it.
Yep, yep.
A little bit of karma got me.
Yep, yep. A little bit of karma. He was being a little, you know, a little mouthy about the short shot and really mouthy about the sharp tail. He really thought that was funny that I would go all that effort and finally scratch it down. But he, same thing. But this time he comes up empty handed.
Yeah.
Right. Where I have mine in hand, he doesn't. But that's part of it. I don't know how many times that'll happen. You make one of the most amazing long shots of your career, and the next point, you shoot three times at a quail and miss it.
Yeah,
going straight away.
It's just amazing. It's just, isn't it?
I don't know what it is. You don't bear down. You think this is too easy. You lose your edge. I'm not sure what happens.
Yeah,
but it happens.
Well, we continue along, and luckily, I was thinking, wow, this is going to be a disappointing way to leave this trip, because other than the blue grouse you might have heard about that I whiffed at, this trip pretty much killed everything gun barrel on.
We shot fairly well this trip.
I thought, wow, what a way to end this trip. But we go on another quarter way around this thing, and my short hair Harley locks up. I mean, rock solid locks up. And
like a single quail was there.
Yes, just like the end of his nose, thinking, no way.
Yeah, because this isn't normal for prairie chickens. I've seen that hunting them maybe a couple of times in my career.
Yeah, usually you'll get the high head point, right?
And the birds will be 10 to 15, 20 yards away.
Yeah, and of course, this green conditions, I wasn't even real sure. Normally you're not hunting something so green, not sure what kind of scenting conditions they'd have anyway, you know? But, I mean, he locks down, and so I kill that bird, thank goodness.
Yeah, it was a prairie chicken.
Really shameful.
Yeah, it came right out of there, and it was one of those where it was so close to the dogs, and it was so close to us that you had to wait for it to clear the dogs. Like always, you know, you got to be safety, you know, practice safety first, of course. And but you did kill one off a point off your own dog, which was great.
Yeah, then so that way I didn't have to end my western hunt with a five shell whiff on a double. So so we trade places now, right?
Yeah, because obviously these birds are closer to the edge, and I'd been walking further out in the field.
I was the wheel man, and so we trade sides and don't walk very far. And
yep, one gets up, not very far away, and I, it doesn't. Dogs aren't around it. I almost step on it, so I made that shot. And so we both ended up with a chicken out of that field.
Ended up with three chickens for the day, for the morning. And
hunting from about 8 o'clock to 10:30.
Yeah, we only had 2.5 hours.
So we had
three more prairie chickens. And
then we hit the road.
It was a pretty good wrap. So we're rolling now. We're almost to Lincoln, so we're making good time. But, you know, all in all, it turned out to be a really good stop. Hunting a place we'd never hunted and a neat ranch. And my goodness, just if you're a prairie guy like we are, just seeing miles and miles and miles of contiguous prairie is just, it makes your heart feel good.
It does. It makes you feel really good because we come from a state where our prairie chicken numbers are at a critical level where that they could blink out and be gone with a couple of years of bad weather events. We're down to so few birds. In fact, I had birds in my district up until 2012, and they finally blinked out. It was the southernmost population of prairie chickens in our state. They were living in an 80-acre piece of grass. Everything else had been farmed. These birds were hanging on. I got to give them credit. They were trying to live and do their things in 80 acres. I felt so bad for them, and they eventually blinked out. So to come from a state where prairie chickens are hanging on by a thread and they're state endangered in our state, to go to a state that has abundant prairie chicken numbers, abundant sharp-tailed numbers, vast acres of rangeland that's well-managed, well-taken care of, prairie chickens in Nebraska appear very secure at this point.
Yes, particularly where we were at. Yeah. This has got to be as one of the more secure populations that I've ever been around.
I've trapped or hunted prairie chickens in the Flint Hills of Kansas, the Smoky Hills of Kansas, and now Nebraska, and it's the highest density of prairie chickens that I've seen, and it's because, and again, I don't know how many times we can stress this, it's about usable space. Everywhere that we looked, there was usable space for prairie chickens, and they were thriving there because of that usable space. Now, the weather conditions were a little bit different. They had a rainy summer, so brood production probably wasn't great. In fact, I think we only killed one juvenile prairie chicken of the ones that we killed. And part of that is because we were targeting leks, which had mostly males, adult males around them. But I did harvest a juvenile prairie chicken out of the alfalfa. So it looks like production may not have been great, but that's not a function of the landscape. That's just a weather thing. That's what game birds deal with. It's vast areas of usable space. Game birds are a landscape species. We always talk about quail. Kyle and I do, and people try to manage quail on small areas. They try to force them into a box. Quail are a landscape species. They do best at larger landscapes. Same thing with pheasants. Same thing with prairie grouse. So think about these landscapes, and when you're thinking about upland game birds and management, we need to be thinking of a larger scale than we normally think about.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the whole talking about them blinking out in Missouri and blinking out even in our own districts. Here, right. We're biologists and we're admitting that they've blinked out in our district. Well, it's a scale is the issue.
Right.
So we've got some prairie. You know, I manage a couple prairies that are a couple sections, and I got some prairies that are a half section. That ain't cutting it.
No.
We're talking thousands of acres of contiguous prairie.
Right.
To sustain a population. And Missouri just doesn't have that. No. Even where we do have it, we've got a 3,000 acre prairie up around, you know, El Dorado Springs in Missouri, and that's not cutting it. The population is about to be gone from those areas as well. So it's just a scale thing. we've lost too much habitat in Missouri, and, and they're just, we still got a few. They're state endangered. Future isn't bright, but on these huge landscape scales, they're hanging on and doing quite well, actually. They're thriving here. And it's not just chickens. I mean, just grassland birds in general. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I've never seen so many meadowlarks.
Yeah, western meadowlarks everywhere. There's
horned larks on the short stuff up at the leks. They like stuff really. We had other, I don't know, different just kinds of sparrows. I'm sure there's...
There were some birders that would have been able to figure it out.
I'm sure there's Henslow sparrows up there this far,
Had a great time out there doing birding for sparrows. There was all kinds of sparrows jumping up. There
dogs would even get birdie on them.
Yep, yep. Burrowing owls in the prairie dog town. So these large, intact landscapes really hold the key to conservation successes because they have everything that these species need in fairly close proximity. These large landscapes, they have all the resources that these animals need, and it was really encouraging to see on this trip landscapes from forested high sage interfaces and plateaus with bluegrass to huge vast basins and plateaus of sage that had abundant. We picked up horned lizards, we picked up all kinds of different stuff, badgers, the whole gamut of stuff from pronghorn, mule deer, all kinds of birds out there that I have no idea what we saw, ferruginous hawks, plenty of them, and then to move into the sand hills and to see another intact landscape full of game, full of life, it was great. It was so encouraging.
Yep, sure is, and really enjoyable. It turned out to be a great trip, not just for the harvest. We were lucky. We had some pretty good harvest, but just to see these landscapes and to see them this intact, we just don't get to see a lot of that back where we're at in the Midwest. And, of course, as you go east, lots of times it even gets worse as far as grasslands, where you're going to have less and less of that. So these grassland birds, it's been a big deal here lately. Audubon's released a bunch of information, and they're the most imperiled suite of birds there is.
Yes,
forest birds aren't doing as bad. Wetland birds aren't doing as bad. The grassland birds are the ones struggling the worst.
They're the most imperiled species, suite of species. We always hear about tropical rainforest and save the rainforest and losing rainforest when that's important. But we are losing grasslands at dramatic rates. We lost a lot of grasslands in the past, and grassland loss is still going on. And we need to really start thinking about and teaching our kids as much about the North American grasslands as we teach them about the Brazilian rainforest.
Absolutely.
Kids should know that these grasslands in North America are critically important.
And it's not just birds. It's all these species. It's carbon sequestration, climate change buzzword, and everybody wants you to plant trees everywhere and save the, these prairies sequester more carbon than the forest, but nobody ever talks about that.
Yeah.
So, just an amazing environment, an amazing landscape to be in.
Yeah. I don't have anything. The only thing I have before we wrap up is Matt and Adam will probably be posting some pictures of our hunts on their Land and Legacy Facebook or Instagram. And also, Kyle and I are available as habitat consultants for upland game bird species, for other upland habitat. We would love to come anywhere in the country to visit your property. If you're interested in anything from bobwhite quail to prairie grouse, we have the experience, we have the knowledge, we have the know-how to help you improve your habitat and improve populations on your property. So if you're interested in that, Kyle and I would love to come visit you. Just get a hold of us at info@landandlegacy.tv.
Yep. That's it. We're going to roll on down the highway, and we'll catch you next time.
See ya.
Yeah.